Welcome, everyone, to another snazzy episode of Podcast Them Softly. Tonight, I am joined with a returning guest, William Wisher. Doesn't really need an introduction, but I'll give him one anyway. You guys should remember him from an episode last year. Mr. Wisher's credits include writing the first two Terminator films with James Cameron, penning the Sylvester Stallone vehicle Judge Dredd, The 13th Warrior, as well as The Exorcist: The Beginning. Bill also has a vast resume as an uncredited script doctor, along with executive producing my favorite Die Hard sequel, Live Free or Die Hard. When we last chatted with Bill, he was in production on IT with his friend and collaborator John Moore, in which Bill co-wrote and executive produced. Tonight we're going to focus on IT, which is available for purchase or rent on Amazon.com as well as other streaming outlets and is now streaming on Netflix. Thank you very much for coming on to talk about IT, which is a film that I very much enjoyed.
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well. So why don't you tell me how this project came about or came about your way?
It came to me through John Moore, the director, and we'd been developing, you know, material, and we wrote a TV pilot that we were shopping, and, you know, it was just, I've known him 6 or 7 years now, and so he came to me with this script, and that was a draft written by Mark Kay. And the idea was, we liked the idea, but we pretty much tossed it and kind of reinvented it. I ended up sharing credit with him because that's the way the guild works. But we it was written for a much younger family guy and all of that. So, but it came to me through John, and John said, "There's something in this. You know, give it a read." And I did. And then he and I sat down and just started collaborating on what it could be. And it ended up, you know, being what we shot, pretty much. It took us a while. Also, we spent time. Pierce Brosnan was already attached, but not, I mean, he could have walked away at any point. So he was attached, but his participation was contingent upon script approval, right? Because he's no dummy. And so we also, not only did Moore and I spend time talking about it, we went out to Pierce's house once we had, you know, the vision in our head a couple times and talked to him. And that was great. Pierce Brosnan is a wonderful, gentle, real gentleman and just a great soul. And he has his house out in Malibu, and we'd be sitting on the sand overlooking. It's a very Hollywood moment, you know, sitting in beach chairs overlooking the Pacific Ocean and talking about IT. And we did that. It took us a few months to get it in the right kind of shape. And then we went into pre-production. So, anyway.
The themes of this film, I've said this to you before about how I feel there's some kinship between Die Hard 4, which is my favorite Die Hard sequel. I love that film, and I'll champion the shit out of that movie for the rest of my life.
Thanks.
And how do you personally feel about social media and privacy in the digital age?
There's no such thing as privacy anymore. How do I feel about it? I don't know. I guess the shortest answer is that I think it's a bit dangerous. I think that it's, especially for younger people who didn't grow up in a world, where this stuff didn't exist. And so therefore they have no sense of, the vulnerability it gives them. Now, me, I grew up, there were rotary phones when I was a kid, you know,
right.
And so I have a sense of, even though it's been around for a while now, a sense of the newness of this and what privacy used to be like. So I have something to measure it against and can kind of discern where, you could be wandering into trouble, or just, you know, even the way your life is different now. I mean, I can be reached 24/7 just about anywhere on the planet now. And that didn't used to be the case, you know. So it's all changing. It's all different. There really isn't privacy. I mean, there's social media. I'll get to that in just a second. But every computer has a camera in it now. But every street corner in major cities have a camera in them now. Stores have a camera in them now. So you're being – it doesn't necessarily mean that anyone's looking at you, but you're being recorded by machinery just about every second of your life, not to mention everybody walking around with cell phones, you know. I mean, the Zapruder film, and for, you know, all of your listening audience who's under 100 years old, that, you know, that was the Kennedy assassination. There was a guy with an 8mm camera and just happened to be filming and recording it. Well, now if there's a car accident, there's like 50 people that already have cell phone video. And so that's changed everything. When it comes to social media, I'm just, you know, not going to say anything that I'm sure hasn't already been said, but it's intrusive. It changes relationships. And again, more with young people than with older people, because older people were already trained to have face-to-face conversations with actual human beings. And, kids, one of my favorite stories about this is a friend of mine has a daughter, and when she was about 14, she's about 20 now, she was about 14, she had a girlfriend, and, my buddy John would pick her from school, or take her here, or take her there, her and her girlfriend, and they would sit in the back seat, and they would not talk to each other, they would text. They were, 11 inches apart, but they were texting, and partly because they didn't want to hear, they didn't want him to know what they were saying, and partly because it's just common now for people to be, you see it in restaurants, you see it everywhere. A couple have sitting down having dinner, and they're both on their damn phones. Or checking Facebook or Snapchat or whatever the hell they're doing, and am I a fan of that? Absolutely not. But it's like complaining about rain. You're not going to do anything about it. It's not going anywhere. So it's a thing that you have to manage. Now, the entire film is at least half about that. The other half of the movie, I think, is about anger and manipulation and all of that sort of thing. That kind of technology that's very intrusive is absolutely at the center of what IT is about.
Does IT get made pre 9/11?
Probably not. Partly because 9/11. Well, first of all, a lot of the technology that exists now, and certainly social media and all of that, and the ubiquitousness of cameras everywhere, I don't think any of that existed in the 90s. I mean, there were cell phones, but they were mostly flip phones. When did the smartphone come out? About 2005 or 6, I think.
Yeah, around that time.
The answer to your question is absolutely not, because it would be a science fiction film if you made it pre 9/11. Yeah, I mean, literally, it would be a science fiction movie, because this stuff didn't really exist. And isn't it amazing how much the world has changed in 15 years, or 16 years? It's phenomenal to me. I feel all of it. I mean, some of it's cool and certainly convenient, but I think 9/11 in many ways has changed certainly America. I mean, I've traveled the world a bit since then. Haven't been in the Middle East. 9/11 sure changed the Middle East, but it's changed Europe. It's changed Asia even. seems everything. You know?
No, I agree, and that's one of the reasons why I love this film so much, is because it threads the needle of being contemporary and where we're at as a culture.
Uh-huh.
With technology, with surveillance, with, you know, smart houses, smart TVs, smart cars, everything is interlinked by, you know, our computer, our phone. Yet, bringing back to what you originally saying, it's a classic story of, you know, anger, rage.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very interested as to how you were able to thread both of those together so seamlessly.
Well, that's a hell of a compliment, and the first thing I want to do is thank you for it. Because that really was our intention. You know, all stories revolve around characters. So you could have made IT. I'm going to go back and revisit your last question and use that to answer or comment on this one. IT could clearly have been made before 9/11. It probably was. You know, the idea this wouldn't have had any technology in it, but the idea of a psychopath worming his way into a family's life. And then when they realize he's nuts and try and make him go away, you know, they find that that's much more difficult and everything escalates. But the fact that it is post 9/11, and that technology does exist. We live in a world in which is saturated with that sort of surveillance and social media and all of that stuff. I think it works because the story is still the story, the character part of the story I'm talking about. And what we did was we simply wove technology through it as a catalyst for a kind of a classic, you know, it's almost a horror story in a way, you know, it's certainly a thriller. But it's the idea of inviting someone unknowingly, inviting someone into your life, not knowing that they're, you know, very destructive and abusive and threatening is a scary thought, you know, and it can happen.
Oh, yeah.
You can strike up a friendship, you know, with someone and then slowly begin to realize, you know, that they're obsessive and nuts and crazy. And then, you know, jettisoning that person out of your life can be really difficult, you know, especially if they decide that they don't want to go. So the other thing that we did, John Moore and I had a lot of chats about this. If you'll notice, there's not a whole lot of specific technological speak in the movie. I mean, there's some,
right?
But we didn't want to get into, you know, like, oh, he's using Guccifer 2.0, or he's using, you know, a lot of this stuff, because it changes so fast that, you know, the movie comes out in March, and then, you know, by December, all that technology is obsolete,
right?
And then it just seems like silly. So we actually kind of wanted, you know, we wanted to portray what the stuff can do, because you can do everything, I think, pretty much everything that you see Ed Porter do in the movie in terms of intruding in the family and watching everybody and all of that kind of stuff and the Photoshop skills and that are part of it. All of that's real. But we wanted to kind of make it more like, yeah, he just does that, rather than specifically try and say he's doing that using this particular toolkit, because we wanted the film to you know, kind of last longer than the shelf life of any particular specific types of technology that he's using. So it's a little bit like magic in a way, but that was intentional, because I don't think people noticed. I mean, we certainly could have done it the other way, you know, using, you know, very specific current day technological slang and you know, name the programs he's using and so on. But we decided not to do that on purpose because half of them might be obsolete by the time the movie comes out.
Right, and one thing that I really loved was the opening of the film, or I should say the opening credits, the kind of the somebody on CNBC or a money market network talking about Mike Regan's Uber for the rich with a private jet, and I really liked that because I had never thought of anything like that before, and I don't even know if something like that exists, but that definitely seems like something that would be happening in the near future if it already isn't in existence.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think what completely complements the digital flow of the film is Tim Williams' score. I think is fantastic. And
yeah,
I
love
noticed
the score.
That instantly.
He did a great job. He did a great job. And then some of the other music cues that we used, I enjoyed a lot. And that was really all John Moore. He was, he knows what he likes, and he's got a real good ear. And you know, he came out of, a long time ago, but he came out of the rock video world, and working with U2, he shot a couple of their things, I think. And so he's got a great ear for music, and I always love the music that he picks, And if you like that, that was Mr. Moore, and the score is really lovely. I say lovely. It's kind of spooky, but it works great. It's perfect.
Yeah, you bring up John Moore's background. I always felt that he was part of the cream of the crop that came out of the MTV music video world, like the Scott Brothers.
And he's Irish. He was born and raised in Ireland, and this was a very Irish movie, actually, in its own way. It takes place in Washington, D.C., but we shot the whole thing in Dublin, Ireland, because it was a very friendly environment, and it helped with our financing. They give you certain things, and in terms of money, making your money go further, which is important in just about every movie these days. And it turns out, when it was first brought up, it was like, well, we can shoot this in Canada, or we could maybe shoot it in Dublin. And I shot my right arm up. I vote Dublin. I'd rather spend time in Dublin than Canada. And sorry, Canada. And it turns out I can't remember the architect's name, but the same architect who a couple hundred years ago, designed Georgetown, designed a section of Dublin that looks just like Georgetown. And then there were some modern universities and so forth. And the Smart House was just a house that wasn't really a set. It was a house that existed in one of the suburbs of Dublin up a hill. And was just a fantastic. The house wasn't as smart as we made it, but it had the look that we wanted of a real smart house. And so we retrofitted some stuff inside, some of the panels that you see and so forth and so on. But the house was the perfect setting, for that kind of a place that one would live in, And which I never want to, by the way. You can keep your smart houses, as far as I'm concerned. And not because of the movie, but because I just, don't like that stuff particularly. It reminds me, when I was a kid, there used to be a joke. I was really a little kid that when the USSR was around, and the joke was, in USSR, TV watches you. You do not watch it. And it was funnier back then, I suppose. But that's what smart houses remind me of. You know, it's like, I don't want a TV that watches me. Don't.
No, I hear you. I have a smart TV. I don't think it has a camera in it, but it very well could.
You know, we just got one and haven't hooked it up yet. I mean, we've had a flat screen, you know, a nice
right.
180, what do you call it? DP flat screen.
Right. Yeah.
1080p. Yeah. And I love this thing, you know, but we just got a smart TV and we're waiting for, you know, I don't have a 12-year-old son or it would already be hooked up. So I need to get a guy out here.
Right.
To do that for me. And I remember, you know, it was about 6 months ago, just talking about all this stuff. It's interesting. I was on my computer and I was probably on Facebook, of all things. And anyway, I ran across this thing in the newsfeed that the FBI had come out and recommended. This was a worldwide sort of statement. Not just everybody in America, you know, where we are, where we have jurisdiction, but this is a suggestion for everybody on Earth. Go put a piece of tape over the camera on your computer, because hacking, random hacking, has become such a global problem that the FBI recommends that you just cover the camera when you're not using it. And I was like, well, if the FBI says I ought to do it, that's probably a good idea. And, yeah, there are hackers in all from Asia to Eastern Europe to Russia and everything else who will hack in just to record you. You know, and it's a voyeuristic thing. I don't know. Maybe they're hoping that they can catch some woman with a computer who's getting ready to take a shower or getting ready for bed. Or people having sex. God knows what. But so I went and ordered a packet of like 50 of those little stickers you put over and started handing them out to my friends when they came over. You know, here, you want this. Just take this home. Put it on your computer. The FBI says it's a good idea. So.
No, I hear you. The funny thing is I have a couple friends that do that. Like, I have a laptop like most people. I rarely ever use my webcam or the microphone that's on my computer, and I have a few of them that put a piece of tape over it. I know Mark Zuckerberg did that. That was like a big thing that happened a couple of months ago or something like that. And this brings it back to my original question about privacy. But, you know, I know everybody has a different opinion on it, but I don't cover my webcam because, A, I'm not too worried about it, and then, like, B, if somebody's going to hack in and watch me type on my laptop or do whatever I'm doing on my laptop, it's like, joke's on them, because they're not going to see anything, you know? It's like, well, if you want to fucking sit there and watch me for 45 minutes, go right ahead. All I'm going to be doing is, you know, watching a movie or writing about a movie or something like that. But, yeah.
Well, I tend to agree with you, you know. And when I'm working on my computer, you know, I'm usually dressed, so I'm not too worried about that. But it's just the idea of
right.
Of it is just kind of creepy to me, you know. And I don't know if we're there yet, but wouldn't it, you know, in some cases be a perfect way to have someone case your place? In case they want to rob it, you know, let's have a look around on the inside. And if you have a laptop, you are prone to pick it up off. Now, I work at my dining room table, like almost all writers. I don't know why, but we do. I guess it's the largest flat surface in your house. So every writer I know is like, do you have an office? No, I took over the dining room. And, you know, but most people with laptops will take them and then they'll go into their bedroom at night, you know, and then they'll, you know, they'll move it around the house. And, you know, I don't want to sound too paranoid. Because I don't actually spend a whole lot of brain power thinking about this, but we're talking about it. So, but, you know, I mean, why not? If I was, you know, I often kind of sit down and imagine if I was a really evil bastard, what could I get up to? You know, I mean, what would be a good thing for an evil bastard to do, and which is, you know, kind of half the way I spent my time writing this movie IT. And So I just think it's a good idea. So when we get off this podcast, I'm going to do me a favor and go get a piece of black electric tape and just put it over the camera on your laptop.
I promise I will do that. For you asking me, I will do that. I have Star Wars duct tape that I've been just wanting to use for so long. I will use that and put it over my camera.
Perfect.
And speaking of evil bastards, James mm-hmm. Frenchville as Ed Porter is amazing. And
oh, isn't he good? Yeah.
Dude, he's so good. And I have a couple of questions about him, and I guess I'm going to start off with two.
Okay.
How much fun was it to write that character?
Oh, it was a blast.
Right, I bet. And then the second question was, what's the most important pedigree for making a psychopath like that for cinema? You know, because he's got to be fucking evil, right?
Well, yeah, you know, but there's an interesting thing that we wanted to do in this movie. And again, Mr. Moore and I spent a fair amount of time talking about it, and which is Mike Regan is also not the nicest human being on earth. Now, he's not nuts, but I want to get to Ed and James in a second, but I want to start with Mike, and then we can return to him. When we were mapping this thing out verbally, one of the things that John Moore said is, you know, ideally, I mean, we knew this film was going to be about, among other things, you know, the anger and the clash of these two guys who both have anger issues, and that Mike Regan started life as a bit of a thug, and then as he became successful, kind of polished himself up, you know, to present himself as this, you know, successful, polished sort of guy who, you know, runs in the right circles and all of that stuff. But underneath that is this kid he used to be. And Ed Porter, you know, kind of pulled that guy out from the Mike Regan that we first meet. Now, getting back to Ed Porter and, you know, the pedigree for all that, what John was saying is I kind of want people for a while in this movie. Ultimately, Mike Regan is the good guy or the better guy because he's protecting his family, and he didn't really ask for any of this to happen. So he's really more reactive than proactive. But on the other hand, Ed Porter, you know, he was kind of fucked from the moment he was born. And there's a whole scene in the movie where, you know, they go into his background and his dad left, dad commits suicide, as I recall. And then he was on, you know, all these different drugs as a kid, and he had issues and he had problems. And so there's some, I did want to create as much as we could, a kind of a sense of, it's not sympathy, certainly understanding that he didn't just wake up one day and decide I'm going to be a bastard. Cause nobody ever does that. Everybody justifies or feels justified in their actions. So John Moore wanted this. He said, you know, for a while, I want people to kind of think, well, maybe I'm rooting for Ed Porter. Well, maybe I'm rooting for Mike Regan. And it's like, I'm not sure which one, is really the real bad guy here for a time. And of course, you know, as the movie continues to unfold, it's kind of like, okay, all right, I'm picking Mike Regan.